A Radiance in the Gulag by Njola Sedulnicka. Chapter 11. Exile. Toward the end of my term, they took me away to exile without, of course, telling me where. My journey to Siberia lasted a whole month, with stopovers at transfer points at Putna, Chelyabinsk, Novosibirsk, and Krasnoyarsk. Njola described in one of her letters in more detail the terrible ordeal she endured on her way into exile. I left Barnashevesh on August 24th. The camp's head bookkeeper came to see me just before I left and told me to write her a letter when I reached my destination, giving my address because otherwise she would not know where to send my money. And if it weren't for good people, I would have starved until my first salary. That would certainly not be healthy after a difficult 20-day journey. Thank God there are good people everywhere. And they helped and continue to help me in many ways. I spent 1 week each in Chelyabinsk, Novosibirsk, Krasnoyarsk prisons. There's no need even to speak of cleanliness and other hygiene necessities. But a lucky coincidence, I managed to avoid getting lice. I fought the bedbugs with all my might, and the women who have become accustomed to them laugh heartily at my expense. To my misfortune, I did not learn to sleep with the bedbugs biting. During the trip, I had the flu and an ear infection. There was no medical attention, and now, as a souvenir, I have one deaf ear. Thank the good God that the other hears well. It would be wonderful if I completely stopped hearing curses and obscene language, but could only enjoy the kind words and the polyphony of nature. From Chronicle No. 30, November 1st, 1977. On the way to Novosibirsk on September 5th, 1977, in a packed railroad car, I suffered a heart attack. The female criminals in my compartment, noticing that I was deathly pale, began shouting that I was dying. I, too, felt that I was at death's door. I had no sensation in my hands or feet, which felt like they belonged to someone else, completely numb. My vision faded, and I could no longer hear anything. However, in my heart was a deep peace, even joy. Thank God it's all over, I thought. I was just sorry for my brother who would be tormented by not knowing how or where I took leave of this life. But it was not God's will yet to have me depart this world. Soldiers quickly brought medicine and water and opened a window. When I recovered somewhat, I asked them where they would have put my body if I had died. They answered that they would have left it in the prison at Novosibirsk. They transported me together with female criminals, and I was with them in the same prison cells except in Pskov, where they kept me isolated. I had nothing with me in the way of food or clothing. Anything decent I had left at the concentration camp, since the need was greater there. So there was nothing to take from me. It sometimes happened that the female criminals, seeing that I had nothing, used to share their food with me. They were very interested in my case, and the fact that I was being transported into exile. There's no exile for female criminals, and they thought that it was only in the Tsarist times that people were hauled off into exile. "You're going to be in exile just like Lenin," they said. Being together in the same prison cell for a week at a time, we used to talk a lot. I never disguised my beliefs. I used to say grace before and after eating, pray, tell them to their face that their lives were wrong, and that living as they did, they would never be happy. I used to be very kind to them because they were so unfortunate. Feeling, perhaps, that I sincerely wished all of them what was good, they were all good to me in return, and I never experienced from them any injustice or derision. Altogether, I was with female criminals 4 months, 2 months in transport, and 2 months in the hospital. In the Novosibirsk prison, I spent a week with three women from Petropavlovsk, sentenced to 15 years for murder. When they were just barely 13, they had begun to engage in robbery, together with a 14-year-old boy. In the evening, on out-of-the-way streets, they would assault lonely passers-by, maiming or even killing them, and then taking their money. They took nothing but money, of which they never found much. "After all, we have to live," they said. "We need something for booze, for butts, and to get decked out." They had begun smoking at the age of 10. They complained that they had been too severely sentenced, since they hadn't done anything. One of them had been given 2 years and another 2.5, and a third, as the ringleader, was given, I believe, 3 years or a little more. As minors, they would not have to serve half their sentence. Female criminals are always being amnestied. The terrible thing was that they did not consider their barbarous behavior a crime, but a normal phenomena. We have to live. These are the fruits of atheism. If there is no God, anything goes. Who can count those millions of dehumanized prisoners who, behind barbed wire, live a truly hellish life, brimming with the worst kind of amorality, cruelty, and hatred? Although it is truly sad that the Soviet Union is one great concentration camp, only the degrees of discipline differ. People from whose hearts God has been torn sink relentlessly into a morass of rottenness, considering evil to be good and being ashamed of the good. Only when I ran into those unfortunates did I appreciate what a great treasure is faith in God and how great is our resulting responsibility. Are we doing everything possible to help others? At the end of the transport, I found myself at the prison in Krasnoyarsk, where I spent a whole week in a cell half underground packed with female criminals. The transfer points, huge prisons, are everywhere overcrowded. This is the one area in which the Soviets annually exceed the plan, and the number of unfortunates are constantly growing. From Krasnoyarsk, in order that my exile truly be 100 times worse than the concentration camp, as the Czechists in Sarnitz had promised, they decided, on orders from the KGB, to take me out to the taiga, together with 8 male alcoholic criminals, to cut timber. In the taiga, the bear is the prosecutor, the wolf is the attorney, and the criminals ride roughshod. This is how the Czechists plan to carry out their words uttered in Vilnius. Say goodbye to Lithuania, you'll never see her again. You're in our hands and we'll do what we want with you. But the poor things did not know that we are all in the hands of God, and that without his consent not a hair falls from our head. How different are the thoughts of short-sighted human beings from the plans of God. From the prison in Krasnoyarsk, they flew me and the 8 criminals to Boguchny, 400 kilometers north of Krasnoyarsk. In Boguchny, they took us in a van to militia headquarters, from where they were supposed to drive us 60 kilometers out into the taiga. However, that day, September 19th, 1977, the van which was supposed to take us broke down, and we stayed overnight in Boguchny. Even in the militia yard in Boguchny, 3 of the criminals were arguing over whose prize I would be. I trusted in the protection of our Heavenly Father, and remained calm. The militia building stood on the bank of the Angara River. I admired the beautiful Angara, about 2 kilometers wide at Boguchny, winding nobly among the forest-covered hills. The leaves, with their autumn coloring of yellow, green, and red, reminded me of the Lithuanian tricolor. It was a sunny day. I thank God for nature's great beauty, and for his love for us, who are so unworthy of it. After a while, I was summoned and told that, at the request of the criminals, the cleaning lady for the detoxification center had agreed to take me home for the night, so that I would not have to spend the night on the floor in the high-ceilinged cell of the center, with the 8 alcoholics in whose company I had been brought there. Our warden agreed to let me spend the night at the lady's house, ordering her to bring me back at 9 o'clock in the morning to the militia station, from where they were supposed to take us to the taiga. He did not let me go to the post office, which was nearby. I wanted to send a telegram to my brother in Vilnius and let him know where I was, since he had not received a single letter from me in 4 months. "When you get where you're going, you can write then," a militia official told me. The cleaning lady took me home. Her little house was just across the street from the militia building. She told me that they were taking us to the taiga, where there were no inhabitants for a radius of 40 to 50 kilometers and no transportation, except for occasional passing vehicles. Anyone coming to visit me would have to go on foot and look for me out in the taiga, and, of course, it would be impossible to find me. I inquired whether they needed a cleaning lady or a dishwasher in Boguchny, since if I could remain there, it would be easier for friends and relatives to visit me. I discovered that there was a 2-story school, where 7 cleaning women were supposed to be employed, since the school had 2 shifts. Only 2 were working, and a 3rd had been discharged for excessive drinking. While we were speaking, the school's charwoman, Anya, my age, approached. We arranged with her to call on the manager at 8 o'clock the next morning to see whether she would employ me as a charwoman. "If they don't take you," said Anya, "I'm going to quit on the spot. I'm working for 3.5 people, and they're paying me for only 2.5. I'm exhausted." They were glad to hire me, since no one else was available. Everyone drinks too much. The militia officer in charge of the exiles agreed to leave me to work and live in Bolchny. For this, the poor man got into trouble with the KGB. How dare he leave me in Bolchny without their knowledge? By September 20th, 1977, I was working as a charwoman in the Bolchny Middle School and living with Anya in the apartment assigned to her by the school. Neola's reflections in a letter at this time reveal her extraordinary character. "And so I am free again. What a great joy that is. I fill my lungs with the pure taiga air. I rejoice in the space, in the innocent eyes of children. Thank the good Lord for the beauty of nature, for the spark of kindness in the souls of people." From the Chronicle, number 30, November 1st, 1977. Only that evening were the 8 criminals transported out into the taiga. Obtaining some cheap moonshine somewhere, they became intoxicated and got into a fight. They killed one of their number and dismembered the corpse. 2 of them they maimed, breaking their hips and splitting one's head. I later saw one of them in the hospital at Bolchny, recuperating, and the others I met by accident in the street. They all assured me that I was very fortunate, because if I had gone with them into the taiga, surely I would not have lived more than a day. "We drank ourselves into a white-hot fever, and we can't remember what we did. The militia didn't show up until 4 days after the fight, when the injured began looking for help and the corpse was already putrid," they told me. Thus, the KGB's plan to destroy me physically failed. Neola's reflections in a letter while she's in exile are pertinent here. "Without the grace of God, man is the most miserable of beggars. That is loudly evidenced by the millions of spiritual paupers who have not had the fortune to know and love the good Lord, and have been wandering the backroads of life since childhood. I met many of them on my journey, and regardless of how low they have fallen, the spark of goodness, which a kind word ignites, smolders in each of them. How very essential is God's grace to their souls, so long tortured by evil. Let us pray, let us sacrifice, because the ranks of spiritual paupers are growing by leaps and bounds. I saw for a fact how miserable man is without God." From the Chronicle, number 30, November 1st, 1977. At the middle school, the work was hard. Outside, it was muddy, and after recess, the pupils returning to class from the schoolyard would bring in so much dirt that it was necessary from morning till night. The dormitory cook, seeing how hard I worked, took pity on me and told me that the hospital needed a nurse's aide, and that job would be easier for me. As Neola wrote concerning her job in Bolchny, "The middle school had not yet been repaired, and our students are studying in the grade school in a second shift from 2 p.m. We also go to work in the afternoon. We ring the bell for classes and recesses. We keep the hallways clean, and after class, we give the building a thorough cleaning." There was a huge amount of work to do because there were too few cleaners, and Anya and I had to do the work of 4. The day before yesterday, a third cleaner was hired, and now it's much easier. Besides, my strength is slowly returning. It shows how important freedom is. 10 days in freedom, and I am already standing more firmly on my feet, and even a strong wind no longer frightens me. My weakness is passing. I tire less at work, and feel that I would soon be strong as before in freedom. My money from the labor camp has not yet been sent. If it were not for good people, I would have had to starve. I get along with people. Everyone is friendly and good to me. I also try not to be indebted to anyone. We live very harmoniously. My sincerest to all who remember me. May the good Lord bless and keep all of you. From Chronicle, number 30, November 1st, 1977. In October 1977, I was visited by Bronju Kobetke and Ludius Smitus, the latter having served 23 years in a concentration camp. What a pleasure the visit was! The 3 of us, after cleaning the schoolrooms and corridors, went for a walk and together thanked the Lord for everything. Vron Kibitka and I went to the hospital, where they agreed to hire me for the maternity ward, since I was a certified nurse and had worked in the children's home. They promised me a private room in the dormitory. On November 1st, 1977, I began work in the Bolchny Hospital. the hospital's chief of staff, a former exile and Lithuanian, Mikislavas Buktus, was on vacation when I went to work. He was not even in Butmi at the time. Nevertheless, they later constantly harassed him for employing me, and the KGB demanded that I be discharged. However, the courageous doctor would reply, "She's doing good work. You'll have to give me a written order to discharge her, but I'll do so." The KGB never beats you with its own hands, but uses the hands of hirelings and intimidated people. When they could not intimidate the chief of staff, they began to circulate malicious rumors. Militiamen went about Bolchny, telling the residents that they had brought a believer to town who had gone to work in the hospital and was now poisoning mothers and giving birth to their newborn and giving them tablets poisoned with little angels. Moreover, she was supposed to have in her possession a radio receiver and transmitter, sending all sorts of state secrets abroad. Thus I was painted as a terrible criminal, and no one was supposed to have anything to do with me, speak with me, or even sell me anything. Otherwise, they too would become state criminals, and for some time people feared and avoided me, but this lasted only a few months. The first to find me in the hospital were the Baptists. We became good friends and used to pray together. In Bochny there are about 50 of them, many of them young and active. I'm very grateful to them for their moral support and friendship. They accepted me like a sister. May the good God reward them. They joked about the fact that if it weren't for the stories originated by the KGB, they would never have come to know me. But when the militia began to repeat the nonsense, they became interested and found me, and thus, for those who love God, all things work for the good. When the KGB became convinced that it was too good for me in Bolchny, they ordered me, through the chief of the militia, to decertify myself, to quit my job, and to move north to the village of Irba as a milkmaid. It was December of 1977, and the temperature was reaching minus 40 to minus 50 Celsius. As I wrote in one of my letters at the time, "My good times in Bolchny are coming to an end. 1.5 months at the school, 1.5 months at the hospital, exactly 3 months since I've come to Bolchny, and now the good news, I am leaving it for the village of Irba." December 20th, 1977. The village of Irba is 100 kilometers, 62 miles, from Bolchny. When the weather is good, an airplane arrives at 12:20 p.m. our time on Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays. Cows are milked by hand. Work begins at 4 a.m. and ends at 10 p.m., without any days off. The people drink. No one works. December 23rd, 1977, from the Chronicle, number 31, February 2nd, 1978. Yulia Glazier, who was then a political prisoner in Bolchny and is presently in Israel, advised me somehow to delay leaving until January 1978, because on January 3rd, he would end his exile and, returning to Moscow, would organize support for me so that I should not be forced to go off to a second exile on the Irba Soviet communal farm. I thanked him for his concern and said that things would be the way God wanted them for me. His will was more important than anything else. I quit my job and reported to the chairman of the Soviet communal farms in the area so that he might arrange for my employment as a milkmaid at the Irba communal farm. The chairman, surprised, asked why they were assigning me to such hard labor. The communal farm was backward. There was no feed. The milkmaids were drunkards, and I was going to have to work every day without a break, from early morning until late, doing my own job and that of others. I told him that they had promised me the most difficult kind of exile, and that I was not afraid of work, but that I would not be much of a milkmaid since I suffered constantly from fever and would not work for long. The chairman was glad to hear this, and, wishing to help me, said that he did not need any sick milkmaids. He referred me instead to the hospital for a checkup. Accepting his recommendation to the hospital, I returned to militia headquarters to tell them that I was being instructed to get a physical examination. The militia chief was not in, and I saw his assistant. Entering the office, I heard the assistant speaking with a young, dark-haired man about me. When I approached them, the assistant said, "Here is the new milkmaid I told you about. She's educated, industrious, and most importantly, she doesn't drink at all." I asked the assistant why he was sending me into exile if, according to him, I was so well recommended. "Is the KGB giving you a difficult time on account of me?" He turned to me and, covering his mouth with his hand, told me quietly so that the Irba district chairman, sitting in his office, would not hear, "If you understand, then why do you ask?" I then told him that I was not being accepted as a milkmaid, but being sent to get a medical checkup. The assistant replied that even if I were unable to work, I would still have to leave Woodley. They did not need a milkmaid as much as they needed to make life as difficult as possible for me. The militia was carrying out this KGB instruction. They put me in the therapy section for a medical checkup. The head nurse of the section herself checked my temperature every 3 hours, distrusting and burning with hatred toward this fascist. She, a member of the revered party, believed all the KGB's stories. At night, my temperature would be normal, in the morning, up a little, and by evening, up to 100 or 101 degrees. I was bothered greatly by a cough, but they would not give me any medicine, and the woman doctor in the therapy section, who was supposed to be treating me, feared me like the plague and did not approach me in that ward once. It was no joke. I, a public enemy and a fascist, could bring the wrath of the KGB down on her. It was better to keep away from such a woman. The head nurse catheterized my stomach, and afterwards, my bladder. The test continued about 6 hours until blood appeared. I was rescued from that torture by a laboratory technician who came into the ward. Frightened, she withdrew the catheter and said that one must not remain with a catheter inserted for more than 3 hours. The catheterization was the reason why a month later I came down with Botkin's syndrome, jaundice. As for my temperature, the head nurse said, "Think of it, 101 degrees. Is that a fever? That's just the right temperature for a milkmaid to work." I remember, as though it were yesterday, the terrible tragedy of Christmas Eve, 1977. A young nurse's aide came into our ward, and in a voice trembling with emotion, told a patient who was an acquaintance of hers that, in the gynecological section, they had discarded a newborn girl in an unheated storeroom, and for 2 days she had been crying and would not die. Taking some clean water, I asked the nurse's aide to show me there. On a little table, painted white, wrapped in a thin receiving blanket, lay a tiny girl, her face already blue with cold. When I touched her, she began crying weakly. I baptized her, and, hurrying out to the nurse's office, I found them chatting lightheartedly. It was already late at night. Upset, I asked them why they had thrown the innocent child out to die of starvation. Angrily, they retorted, "It's none of your business. The doctor knows best who should live and who die." I replied that it was a doctor's duty to save life and not destroy it. By killing their own infants, they were acting worse than the fascists, who only killed foreigners. They began shouting, "Get out of here! You must have escaped from the nut house to feel sorry for everybody. It's our business. We do what we want." Leaving with a heavy heart, I went to the doctor on duty, but she was of no help either. Right here was a maternity hospital, special cribs for premature infants, warmth and food. But for this child, there was no room there. Never in my life have I had such a sad Christmas. The little girl lived until morning, and when they reported it to the obstetrician who came into the gynecology section, she said, "She should have been thrown out into the scrubbing bucket long ago." Such is their crystal pure communist morality. They have no sympathy for their own innocent infants. So what hatred they must feel for those who think differently. In the hospital, I also met a woman patient who worked at the Irba Soviet farm taking care of calves. She described the chaotic conditions at the communal farm. There was no feed. Everything was neglected, and cows and calves were dropping like flies. They wanted to deduct the cost of the dead calves from their pay, even though they were not exiles. Nyola wrote in a letter around this time about the evils of Irba in more detail. "I have been told clearly by people living here that there is no state farm more backward and neglected than Irba. Against me, they would probably fabricate a case for the deliberate destruction of animals, with a serious indictment." This thought was voiced by the Siberians themselves. Wages are not paid. Some have not been paid since May. There was no bookkeeper. There is complete chaos. Mud, rats, chaos. People are fleeing Irba. As local residents say, a brothel is no place to live. January 6th, 1978, from the Chronicle, number 31. "But we're not to blame that there's no feed," she exclaimed. "I came to Irbo with my husband because they promised me an apartment, and now I really regret it." It was December, and there would be no salary until May. Most of them were drunk, and there was no one to do the work. There were fights and murders. She warned me that I must not, under any circumstances, go to Irba. They would sue me for neglecting the cows and for those which had died. I would have to pay the state compensation, which I would not finish until I died. I thanked her for her kindness, but it was not for me to decide whether I went to Irba or not. When they discharged me from the hospital, January 10th, 1978, certified as healthy and able to do any kind of work, regardless of my night fevers of 100 degrees, I went back to the militia. The Czechists had come from Krasnoyarsk to see the militia chief, and I was told to wait outside his office. After sitting there for a good hour, I decided to go in and ask when he would be free to receive me. When I entered his office, the militia chief was talking to two Czechists. Seeing me, he stood, and spreading his arms, said with a smile, "So you're staying here to live and work?" I did not understand why everything had changed so suddenly, and I replied that it was not my idea, but that it was he who was telling me to leave. The chief of the militia interrupted me, saying, "Live and work in Bochny." Once again, the good God had arranged it so that I remained in Bochny until the end of my exile. The love of God is especially felt at life's difficult moments. Glory, love, and thanks be to him forever. In Bochny, I used to receive many letters and packages from abroad. Niola wrote more about her correspondence in a letter about this time. I began to worry when for a long time I received no letters from my family living in Vilnius, but today I am celebrating. The mail came, and among the other letters there were 5 letters from my brother Jonas Saldunas. Apparently a letter finds it sad to travel by itself, so it waits for companions. It is more fun when there are 5. Many of my notes of only a few sentences do not reach my labor camp inmates, prisoners, exiles, inhabitants of Moscow. Many of my letters disappear during the long journey to my homeland, Lithuania. The customs duties imposed on gifts received from abroad are very high. Chocolate is the most expensive food item, 120 rubles per bar. A package of cocoa is 3 rubles. Fees for claiming clothing are very high. It doesn't matter whether the clothes are new or used. An ordinary synthetic sweater is 25 rubles, a chiffon scarf, 20 rubles, stockings, 5 rubles. Prices are the same as in the stores, or even higher. And if my basic pay is 75 rubles per month, I pay 20 rubles for a small 6-square-meter room. From the Chronicle, number 39, July 22nd, 1979. The postmaster wondered and asked me what people from 20 foreign countries were writing to me. "They write that they love me and are praying for me," I would answer. I would repack the parcels I receive and send them to political exiles whose conditions were more difficult than mine. I knew about 20 of them. Again, the postmaster wondered why I sent everything not home to Lithuania, but to utter foreigners out in the backwaters of Siberia, Yokdia, and Magdan. He asked me who these people were to me. "They are my brothers and sisters in trouble," I would answer. "Even you say that man is brother to man." Girls in the Communist Youth Organization would wonder and ask, "If we fell on hard times like they, would you send us parcels too?" "Of course, if I had your address." To them it was incomprehensible, but they took my word for it. After I had returned to Lithuania, I received cordial greetings from them, saying that they could not forget me. Real love is more powerful than hatred.